Tell me, first of all, why did you go again? You and your wife had already gone.
Yeah, that's the question I keep getting. I went again. I mean, I had I did the first trip for Morning Edition, and then an agent who's been wonderful working on first books with a lot of NPR colleagues of mine came and said this would make a wonderful book. And I told him I thought he was crazy because I had this new job at Morning Edition, didn't think I'd have time. He just said, "Oh, no, just write like a paragraph or two from the train and let's see what where it goes." And then it was write just 8 or 10 pages and I'll look at it. And I knew what he was doing.
Yes.
But I was a willing victim, and so suddenly I had a book proposal and did not totally realize that along the way that this would involve taking another trip. But I really wanted to, if I was going to do this, I wanted to do this trip from a totally different approach, like as a writer, and not thinking about sound and not thinking about collecting tape. So that's one reason. But the other reason is I loved it the first time, and I would probably go back a third time. I mean, it's just a wild, wonderful experience, and you meet people, and it's just crazy. And the amount of distance you cover is just crazy. And there's such a payoff when you get to Vladivostok, and you're sort of on the Sea of Japan, on the Pacific. North Korea's right there. China's right there. You're like, wow, this country is just huge.
And since you brought that up, I was wondering about the mix of people that you were traveling with on the train. Did it change from west to east?
The travelers, the passengers didn't change that much, over the course of west to east. But each train would sort of be different. There's some trains that literally go the whole distance from Moscow to Vladivostok. But along the route, there are some trains that you might catch to do part of the trip that are only traveling, a few hundred miles or going to a couple different cities. And so if you happen to catch a train, for example, that was coming from Central Asia, there would be a lot of men from Central Asian countries who were coming up to Russia to look for construction work. And so that train would have a sort of mood, a certain mood and spirit. And then if you were on a train that was going the entire distance, you might have a family who had, relatives on the other side of Russia and had been saving money literally for years to be able to go visit them, and were getting on this train for, 4 or 5 days to reach some remote part of Siberia to see their family. And they would have just bags and bags full of stuff that they bought in Moscow to bring to their family. And so it varied a lot by sort of which train you were on and also which class of service. The first trip I did, we went mostly in second class, which you had your own compartment, sometimes with strangers. But this trip we did mostly third class, which was just sort of open dormitory rooms. So it made things, you're literally on top of each other when you're passengers. You have to almost step on another passenger's face to climb up into an upper bunk, and everyone's watching you, and it can be completely humiliating because unless you're a gymnast, which I'm not, and there's just sounds. If people were snoring, everyone knows it. If people were drinking and playing music, you're not sleeping that night. It's just crazy.
Or getting ill.
Or getting ill.
Yeah. So about the people then, how did you talk to them? You just introduce yourself and you say who you are, and I'm a writer, and
Yeah, and it would often. And I'm amazed. I mean, it's in Russia, I would say this is not scientific, but on average, more strangers I approach in Russia are willing to chat than even here at home, which is lovely. And I also benefited from having such an amazing travel companion. Sergei Sotnikov is the producer for NPR in Moscow, and I lucked out. He was able to take 5 weeks off and do this trip with me for the book. And if he were someone who was unpleasant and kind of unapproachable, then I wouldn't have, I would have had a hard time meeting anyone. But Sergei is so lovely and so warm, that he and I could just chat with people, and I could say, "Sergei, these fellow passengers look really nice," and I would kind of say hello and in my limited Russian, but then sort of rely on Sergei to get into the nitty-gritty. This is a book. This is what we're doing, and we'd be away and running, and oftentimes it would lead to just lovely, lovely conversation.
Was there anything you took for this trip that you did not take the first trip but wished you had?
I learned the hard way on the first trip that sharing food is a really important tradition on the Trans-Siberian. And my first, literally the first leg of the first trip, this wonderful woman coming from Belarus brought me into her cabin and had Belarusian sausage. She was kind of using it as a baton to wave me into her cabin to say hello. She had this incredible horseradish concoction. It was just delicious. And I realized I had nothing. All I had was a Luna bar that I still had from the plane. And I offered that to her. And I mean, the look she gave me was like, seriously? You're offering me a Luna bar? So I would try this the second trip at each stop. And I didn't have the benefit of having been like in a home where I could prepare something. But I would go to a deli or a store somewhere and just find something that I could at least, you know, say, you know, oh, thank you so much for that absolutely delicious meat from your home. Here are some pastries I bought at a bakery or, you know, in my last stop, just something I could share so I could be sort of part of the fun.
To the people, how is the economy in Russia?
It really depends who you're talking to. I mean, there's no doubt that over the course of Putin's time as the leader of Russia, I mean, people have become better off on average, you know, if you look across the board, which is one reason that, you know, after Yeltsin came Putin, and Yeltsin, you know, led through some terrible economic times, that it's one reason that Putin has remained as popular as he has. But there's also a tremendous amount of inequality, and that really bothers people who grew up in Soviet times, because it's something that's very unfamiliar. So if you are rich, wealthy, well-off, you know, you could be doing really, really well in Russia, and we met a lot of people who were, but there are a lot of people who are just on the other side of the spectrum and are increasingly, I think, growing kind of frustrated because they grew up in Soviet times, and it's a feeling of this is not who we are. This should not be a place where there's this kind of inequality.
And are they trying to do anything about that?
The government or people?
Both.
It's hard to say. I mean, mm-hmm. Putin talks about helping people. It's one thing he talked about when, with the Russian takeover of Crimea this year. You know, Putin said that you will be much better off, you know, in Russia's embrace than you were in Ukraine and in the West. So he certainly talks a good game, and the rhetoric is there. But meanwhile, there are a lot of villages that you go to that have almost nothing. I mean, they struggle to get by. They're communities that are all but dying and losing population. And a lot of people struggle in the country, and you know, I certainly didn't see any evidence that it's changing all that soon.
Mm-hmm. And besides the inequality, you know, what do the folks want?
That's, I think, the $10 million question about Russia. And I just don't think they have figured it out yet. I mean, one thing I took away from these trips is that there aren't many Russians who are crying out for an American system of government, an American-style democracy. You know, you would talk to people who are so scared of the Arab Spring and that upheaval. You know, one person who, you know, played a big role in the book in this village near Yekaterinburg in the Ural Mountains, he told me that what happened to Libyans when Gaddafi was removed from power, they will absolutely not be as well off as they were before, because there were there was stability under Gaddafi. There were assurances that the government would provide basic needs for people. And that's the perception that a lot of Russians have, that this kind of upheaval is a bad thing and that stability comes from a leader like Putin. And I think Russians want a new identity. You talk more and more to people who just feel like the Soviet times, for all of the downsides of it and the tough life, it was just a sense of purpose and identity and pride. And a lot of Russians you meet just say that's missing today, and they want to hold on to something, but they just don't know what it is yet.
And tell me about the arts and culture on the train. Did people bring their instruments? Did you sing with them?
I wish I could say it was as poetic as that. Oftentimes it was people blaring like 80s dance music. Which would often be soundtrack
okay.
on the train. Yeah, not a lot of musical instruments, because that would have been actually perfect. I mean, when you're sitting there drinking cognac or vodka into the night as, you know, the scenery of Russia is flying by and you're on a train, there should have been more instruments. I think you're right. Oftentimes, the vodka, I think, would have made musical instrument playing problematic.
So that's your socialization, the drinking and the eating, too.
Yeah, the eating and the drinking and, you know, you just...
Sharing life.
Sharing life, reading, a lot of tea. I mean, it's funny, even people, you know, that there would be times when a seatmate, we couldn't speak to him at all because he was coming from Uzbekistan. He couldn't speak Russian, couldn't speak English, and we just couldn't communicate. But, you know, one point, we brought out this pastry that I had bought at a place, and I offered him some. And he sort of looked at it really funny and then looked over at his teacup. And we basically had a conversation. I knew exactly what he was saying. You know, we're in Russia. Who would have pastry without tea? That seems ridiculous. And so it was just this silent communication. And it's that kind of sharing in those kind of moments.
Well, that's great. I'm so glad that you had a good time. And I have to ask, were you paid? Was this an NPR trip? Was this time you had to take off?
This was time I had to take off. You mean for the book?
Yes.
Yeah, the first trip was for NPR and that Anna Morning edition. The second trip was all mine. NPR has been amazingly supportive of the book.